This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, hello. Okay, great.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
This is Spark.
This is Spark.
Technology.
Trends.
And fresh.
Fresh ideas.
Fresh ideas.
This
is on the air.
This is
online.
This is Spark.
CBC.ca/Spark.
Today, staying home and letting your robot go to work, why your washing machine is ruining your life, and high-tech toothbrushes. Technology around the house. All in 27 minutes on Spark.
I'm home.
Bad news at the dentist. Our teeth aren't getting clean enough.
This unique electric toothbrush.
A unique toothbrush.
Has reaching bristles.
Bi-level bristles.
Longer, softer outer bristles.
It has a flexible neck.
Selective brushing action.
51% cleaner teeth.
We like to think we're so superior, we don't fall for that atomic age hype anymore. But have you taken a walk down the drugstore aisles lately? Look, we've got the 360 degrees microsonic power toothbrush. That's a good one. Ooh, and the Pulsar. Vibrating bristles, a clean you can feel. And that's just the toothbrush aisle. How about the techno hype in the shampoo aisle? Come on. Pro-V with pyrithione zinc, antioxidant technology, and another one, advanced neutrillium complex, and finally, superior styling polymer. It sounds ridiculous, but obviously we love it because we buy this stuff, we eat it up. Why do marketers use technological language for products that aren't that technologically advanced?
I'm Terry O'Reilly. And I'm a writer and director at Pirate Radio and Television in Toronto.
So from a marketing point of view, what's the rationale behind using technological lingo? Why does that appeal to us so much?
You know what? There are a lot of products with very little differentiating qualities from the competitor's product. Like, for example, toothpaste is a great example of that. There's very little difference between one toothpaste to the next beyond packaging. And a lot of pharmaceutical stuff like that, like shampoos, etc., fall into that category. So the tough thing for marketers is how to make them stand out, because every product wants to sort of get pushed a little, you know, ahead of the others on the shelf. So what they do sometimes is they will find the benefit of that particular product, and then they will find new language to frame it in. And I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Years ago, when I was a teenager, and I remember Certs used to run this long-term campaign on TV for Certs breath mints, and they always said that the reason Certs was so great was because it was the only breath mint with a sparkling drop of retsin.
Retsin, yes.
Right. Now, retsin is vegetable oil.
Really?
That's what it is. But to say vegetable oil isn't very exciting, and it isn't very proprietary sounding. So they took, I guess, the clinical name for vegetable oil, which is retsin, and then trumpeted it and just used it in their advertising.
You know, we actually got an interesting comment at the blog about this.
One thing I find interesting is how technological products and features are named. Some have friendly names like MacBook and mouse and desktop. And then there are others, and I'm thinking of like electronics and some cars. Their names are complicated, and they mix letters and numerical characters. I suppose that's meant to make them more technologically sophisticated.
There is this subcategory of products that get that kind of, you know, the new BFG5280X kind of treatment. What's up with that?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting observation. The most complicated products in our lives need to be named, and the language used around them needs to be very simple to make them appealing and approachable and understandable, like a computer being called an Apple or a Mac is just right. So simple and so inviting. Then there are the most simplest of our products, like a toothbrush, which is, you know, really the bottom of the food chain as far as design goes, needs to be sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And needs to sound like there's a lot of engineering going into it in order for it just to even register on people's radar screens.
So, Terry, when it comes to using this kind of technical or scientific-sounding language, how beholden do you have to be to being actually accurate? I mean, you have to be.
You have to be. As there are quite a few checks and balances in our industry for that. You can't say something is something when it's not.
Right. In fact, the secret clinical strength antiperspirant that I saw, which started me off on this
claim. They were actually the subject of a Better Business Bureau investigation into claims that it was prescription strength, for instance, and the company's claims were verified. So you can sort of, I guess, gussy up the language a little bit, like using the term retsin instead of vegetable oil, but it still has to actually, you can't just make up a thing that's retsin that doesn't...
You can't make it up. Remember this, marketing is trying to put the best possible light on a product. And it's the same thing we all do. You put on makeup when you go on a date. You put on a great suit when you go for a job interview. You're just putting your best foot forward. That's all marketing is.
Well, thanks a lot for clearing this up, Terry. And we knew you'd be the right person to ask because we listen to you all the time on Age of Persuasion, which used to air in our Saturday slot.
Yes. Thank you very much, Nora. Real pleasure talking to you.
You too, Terry. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We love the bright, shiny, techie solution that's going to make our lives whiter, brighter, and younger. But think about the less sexy technologies in your life.
Washers and dryers and dishwashers.
Those everyday technologies that you don't even give a second thought to are having unexpected impacts on the way you live.
Okay, my name's Martin Hand. I'm Assistant Professor of Sociology at Queen's University in Kingston.
Martin specializes in the less sexy technologies.
And how they are part of the stuff of consumer culture.
Martin, we've just been talking about techno-hype. Why do you think we attach such expectations to our technologies?
Well, I don't think we should think of this in terms of as an individual problem, that I attach certain things to technologies, but more of a matter of kind of creeping social conventions about certain kinds of standards. It's partly to do with some of the promises made about these devices, and that applies to all kinds of technologies, as in your phrase, techno-hype. To take the example of some of these mundane devices, such as, say, a washing machine, I think the expectation is to do with how often one might do the laundry gets attached to certain kinds of morality. So, for example, sending your children to school without fresh, clean clothes on is not just being a competent homemaker, it's also attached to, you know, not caring for your children in some way or not looking after them properly. And I think even though these are very ordinary and mundane kinds of machines, when they become wrapped up in deciding how one is to live, then they carry a certain amount of weight. And I think that's the answer I would give it at the present time, yeah.
Right. I mean, they seem to almost be subconscious, because now that you say it, I mean, I often remark that I seem to be constantly doing laundry, like constantly doing laundry. And yet I'm not aware of having any kind of particular neuroses about being a bad housekeeper or whatever. How do we internalize these things?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's not that people don't think about what they're doing, but they become habitual. And that's, in a sense, what we've become particularly interested in, is what kinds of habits and routines materialize, and how do they maintain themselves, and how do they change without us realizing? So, for example, we looked at why it is that people on average completely remodel their kitchen every 7 years as a statistical average. Why might this be the case? They can't simply be kind of greedy or obsessed with having new things. That's never a good explanation. And I think it's the ways in which it becomes attached to things like the arrival of a new baby, say. All sorts of new ideas come about we've got to change everything we do because we've got this new baby now. We've got to stop eating pizza. We've got to be cooking fresh spinach every evening and then freezing it in ice cubes. And in order to do this, we'll have to have a new kitchen because we must eat at the table now, because now we're this kind of family. These are very powerful sets of expectations about how you should live.
Why is it that we don't sort of socially ask ourselves questions about, I mean, we get these new technologies, but we never seem to even really stop to think about how it's going to change the way we're actually living our lives. We just sort of buy into this, you know, labor-saving device thing. When are we going to start asking questions about this kind of stuff?
I think some of these other devices are taken, well, two things. One is that they're taken to be so ordinary as to be not worth thinking about. They're not exciting at all in that way. You know, they don't provoke any kind of any particular kinds of thoughts, like, say, I don't know, a digital camera might, or an MP3 player or whatever it might be. So there's that kind of invisibility to them. I also think that, you know, if you look at the way new homes are built, they're built with a whole range of assumptions about what one will do in that home, what counts as a normal home. So it will come with a huge kitchen area full of appliances, taken as the standard way of living.
Right.
So they're kind of, it's not available for thought, if you see what I mean. It's already built into the environment that we live in, and then we kind of use it accordingly.
Martin, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Continue the conversation at the Spark blog. Maybe you remember the Saturday night bath, or how it used to be all right to have your dishes stacked in the sink in the days before dishwashers. I'll be online. Hope you will be too. cbc.ca/spark or give us a call 416-205-8974. Last week, we talked to Saul Greenberg about designing ambient computers, little devices around the house that update you with information but don't get in the way. And here's one of the responses we got on the blog. Liz?
Hi, Nora. Straight from the blog here. Lots of good discussion on the blog this week, just like this one here. So it's from Yvonne in Vancouver, and Yvonne wrote, I have a 95-year-old aunt and an 89-year-old friend who, although being completely independent and able women, do live alone independently.
Right.
At present time, one phones the other one each day to see whether she's still alive. Her words, not mine. Sometimes this call is not what either particularly wants to do or receive, mm-hmm. but it's a way of ensuring that help could be arranged if the call goes unanswered. If somehow Mary's house could simply do something in Joan's house to let her know that Mary is moving around as usual, the improvement to the friends' lives would be welcome. And she goes on to say, I would also be very content to receive reports that my relative and my friend are fine, since I'm probably the one who would actually provide any help. Thanks, Yvonne in Vancouver.
And thanks to you, Liz. It's interesting to think about how, you know, as the population ages, we're going to start to see a lot more technologies developing around, you know, supporting aging people and allowing them to stay in their homes and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's a hot topic.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
Bye. Why be a slave to your gadgets? Take control of your technologies.
It's time for Tom Lucher. He's the guy in Windsor who hates cell phone contracts.
Hey, Nora.
Hi, Tom.
I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Would you agree to eat an artichoke sandwich every day for 3 years?
No, I wouldn't, Tom.
Well, I compare the artichoke sandwich to the cell phone. I've sat through like 2 years of my last contract, and instead of paying the $300 cancellation fee, I just sat through it while I despised it. I could have been clamped onto the top of the signal tower with my cheek pressed against the transmitter, and I still couldn't get more than 2 bars of reception. I mean, what length would you go to get out of a contract?
This is something that people complain about a lot, is being locked into these contracts that they absolutely hate. I think, you know, a lot of people would do a lot of things to get out of them.
Yeah, well, this American guy named Corey Taylor, a.k.a. my new hero, he reached the end of his rope with his cell phone company. And it's because he found out he had to pay $175 to get out of his contract. Mm-hmm. So he resorted to, let's say, an extreme measure.
What did he do? Did he sue?
No. He faked his own death.
What?
He learned from a blog.
That's like a soap opera, he faked his own death.
Yeah, he learned from a blog. This is the only surefire way to kill his contract.
To kill himself. Yeah.
Well, he made a fake death certificate and had a friend fax it to the phone company. But wait, but it didn't work. The company somehow realized the scam, but it did send a strong message. You know, I'd rather die in theory than keep this phone. And it costs less than sending a text message. But can you believe that? Like, it's pretty extreme.
That is pretty extreme. I mean, are there other ways that actually that you can get out of?
If you're not willing to kill yourself, you could join the military and be displaced. Or if you are moving to an area where there's not enough service. That's pretty much it. So if you can prove that you're moving to Baffin Island, well, you're set.
Okay, but Tom, it is a contract, right? I mean, I think that is the point of a contract, right? That you enter into this binding agreement.
Okay, yeah, but Nora, prices in Canada are like crazy. Canadians pay higher wireless fees compared to the U.S. In fact, some of the highest in the world. And it's because partly because we lack the competition. Mm. But there may be hope. There is a website, sellclients.com. It's a company out of Toronto, has a handle on this thing. It was started by this whiz kid electrical engineering student at the University of Toronto. He's using social networking. We all love that. And he's using it to solve the problem.
So you mean people are like joining a kind of a Facebook for cell phone contract?
Not that severe, but you do leave a dossier of information about your phone. See, cell phone companies won't penalize you if you get someone else to adopt the remainder of the contract. So on his site, you can pass it off, pass the buck. So people post the details of their contracts, what kind of phone you have, who's your provider, how many minutes per month, what do you pay each month, that kind of stuff. And people who want short-term alternate plans, they see that contract and they offer to adopt it. It's like subletting apartments, but with phones.
That's very clever.
Yeah. So now that I found the site, I mean, I need to cancel flowers and a hall rental and the backhoe.
What are you talking about, Tom?
Well, my death. Like, my death. Now I don't have to fake my death to get out of the contract. And my wife doesn't have to sign my death certificate.
Right. Thanks for talking to us, Tom.
Thank you.
Once again, that website is sellclients.com.
Spark!
cbc.ca/spark.
Tech trends and fresh ideas.
Breaking news, we have an update on Omelette. Remember that, the iMac of chicken coops? Last time we talked to urban chicken farmer Thomas Kreese, he was anxiously awaiting his first backyard egg. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Nora. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Now, I understand you have some big, big news.
I have wonderful news. We got our first eggs this weekend.
Yay!
Yay! It's wonderful, yes.
So tell me more about it. How did you discover it? Unfold the whole process for me.
On Saturday, we noticed that the chickens were acting a little bit differently than normal. They were clucking and pacing back and forth in their run. And that afternoon, I went downstairs and said, well, what's bothering them so much? And I let them out to range around the yard. And as I was getting ready to clean up, I opened up the nesting box lid from the egg loo. And lo and behold, there was the first egg.
Cool. What did you do?
I did a little happy dance and picked it up and ran inside to share it with my wife and kids. And handed it to my daughter. And the first thing she did was shake it really hard and had to get her to realize, no, that's not what we do with these kinds of eggs.
Right.
I think she was just used to Easter eggs in the garden.
Oh, right. Okay. So did the chickens mind when you took the eggs?
Not at all. They seemed actually a little bit relieved that this, whatever it was in the nesting box, was now gone.
What did it look like? I mean, other than egg-shaped?
I was surprised at how well-formed it was. I'd sort of built up my imagination that the first egg would look differently. I'd been told by some folks sometimes they're really long or really thin or anything like that, but it was a perfect egg shape. It was just smaller than I'm used to. We buy large-sized eggs here. And it looked to be about a small, but it was delicious.
Oh, you've eaten it already?
I have eaten, well, she's actually put out 3 eggs so far, so we've gotten 1 a day starting on Saturday.
Wow.
And this morning I cooked up the second and third eggs. I'm going to blow out the first one and save the shell.
Oh, that's very sentimental. That's lovely. Scrambled? Poached?
No, I actually wanted to enjoy watching the yolks cook on this one, so I did them over medium. And I've actually posted pictures in my blog at urbanchickens.net.
And how do they taste?
They taste absolutely delicious. It was amazing this morning as I poked the yolk, and the golden yolk just kind of oozed out over the white of the whites, and it was just a really creamy texture to it. And the thing that I was surprised the most was just how tough the eggshell was.
Oh.
It was something that I didn't realize in store-bought eggs, just how thin those shells get after time. And on this one, it took a lot of effort to break it, but I didn't break the yolk, and I was very happy.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations, Thomas, and congratulations to the chickens, too.
Well, thank you. I will pass along the congratulations to them and hope that Zuzu starts popping out eggs as well.
Okay. It sounds great, doesn't it? Living locally. But what about living locally and working remotely?
If you want to have a conversation with Ivan, well, you go and talk to him.
Would you introduce us to Ivan?
I'd be delighted.
I could hear the whirring of...
That's the morning.
Oh, we're going to meet Ivan now. Wow.
Ivan, I'd like to introduce you to Nora Young of CBC Radio.
That's not... And he has a nameplate and everything. Should I hold my hand out? Hi, Ivan.
Hi, it's a pleasure to meet you.
I'm trying to shake hands with Ivan, but I can't because he's a robot.
My name is... Ivan Bowman,
And Ivan Bowman is a man, a software programmer who lives in Halifax. But the robot works alongside his colleagues in Waterloo. And with the magic of webcams, the people in Waterloo and Ivan in Halifax can see and hear each other. So can you tell me what we're looking at when we look at the robot?
It's about a person-sized object. Looks like a coat rack with wheels, sort of, but
There's a couple of webcams that would suggest something out of Star Wars, probably. About middle of the unit is a tablet PC where we can see Ivan's face.
And that's where I can see Ivan sitting at his desk in Halifax. And then the bottom, well, it's not very high tech.
Hidden beneath a cardboard exterior are the batteries and the motors and so on.
It's no longer cardboard, Dan. It's MDF this morning.
We've put on a new face for the radio, I guess.
I think maybe you offended him by last description of it.
Nice new duds, Ivan.
So why did his company, Sybase Eye Anywhere, and his boss, Glenn Pauly, go to all this trouble?
It all started when Ivan and his wife moved to Halifax. Ivan is a brilliant engineer, and we were not willing to let him go. And we were not wanting to get distance to get in the way. So we were just sort of talking amongst ourselves off and on over a year or so about, wouldn't it be great if we could build something?
So tell me about a day in the life for your robot.
I'm in my parking spot, and I'll see people as they walk by in the morning with their coats on, and I can tell whether it's sort of a rainy day in Waterloo or if it's a sunny, hot day. And at some point, someone will come over and unplug me from the charger, and then I'm able to roam the halls. So usually I just leave it in the parking spot and work at my space. But then if I do need to talk to a specific person, I'll roll over to their office, see if their door is open and they're available, and then ask if I can come in and talk to them.
That is fantastic.
Hi, I'm Ian McCarty, and I'm the person who designed and built Ivan's robot. And I was thinking, well, you could maybe get an RC truck and put some kind of mast on it.
RC being remote controlled.
Remote control, yes. And then have Ivan somehow control the RC truck and then somehow get the video feed back to Ivan.
Can you show me how it works with your joystick?
So I'm not sure if you can see this, but this is a joystick that I have here.
Yeah, it looks basically like a game console, like you would normally have to play video games in your house.
This left stick controls the camera, so I can point it around. Yeah, so this tablet is using our wireless connection in Waterloo, and then it connects over the public internet to my computer here in my home office.
So what do you get having this virtual presence of yourself here in the office that you wouldn't get just from email and instant message and phone messages and so on?
When I'm participating in a meeting, just using the telephone, I find it very difficult to know what other people are doing or thinking. Is it my turn to speak? Are they all waiting for me to say something? Are they thinking very hard about something that somebody just said? Or are they all just looking off into the distance bored? If you're on the phone, you can't tell. But if I have a camera there and I can point it around, I can figure out when it's appropriate for me to interject with something.
Right. And how has it changed your relationship with your coworkers?
Where I've really noticed it is with sort of the bad news. I wasn't finding out about it very soon. So some of my coworkers had changed the relationship status. And those are the kind of things that I wasn't hearing about being at a distance from other people. The other thing that I do is there's sort of a nice area over there where there's some comfortable chairs and a nice view out the window. So if anybody's wandering by, we can just chat and say hi.
There was some initial trepidation by some of the staff about interacting with the robot, but after a week or two, it really hasn't been an issue.
He just seems like part of the office, and everyone talks to him like he's a real person. So it's, or he is a real person, but like, but like he's not a robot.
Mm-hmm. And does it feel sort of normal as a kind of social interaction? Like, are you able to have kind of social, friendly moments with him?
Yes, so as you can see, so his cubicle is very close to my my office, so we are chatting about, I don't know, how the commute was is this morning and so on.
On your right is my parking zone.
On my right is what?
Is my parking zone. That's where I park overnight. Yeah, and you may see the sign for the pit crew to remind them to plug me in overnight. On two occasions, people were on vacation and I couldn't find someone to plug me in, so I was sort of wandering the hallway forlornly.
Aww.
And I did make it back to my parking zone, but the next day I had to stay there all day as I was recharging.
Right, Ivan Anywhere pit crew charging. Yeah, and I see somebody left you some Timbits. Lucky guy. What's next for the robot?
One thing I've noticed is that it's hard to kind of express how I'm feeling to people. So Ian and I have talked about adding some arms with servos so that in a meeting I could raise a hand to say I have something I want to add, but I'm waiting until it's my turn, so I don't want to interrupt verbally until then, or robot body language.
That's very cool. Can I take a picture with you?
Oh, please, yep. Glenn, is there a nice backdrop for us?
Arms! Then I could shake his hands! Now, I know you're just dying to get a look at that robot, aren't you? You can find pictures of the robot at our blog, cbc.ca/spark. The cool thing about the robot is that it recognizes that in the future of work, there's a barrier to working remotely. Some of the best ideas happen not in formal meetings and scheduled tasks, but in the on-the-fly kind of brainstorming and problem-solving that happens on the shop floor or around the water cooler. The robot creates the kind of casual presence that a conference call just can't. Next week, hacks. If you're not happy with off-the-shelf products, why not change them yourself? We'll learn how to make cool new lenses for digital cameras from the kind of cheap things that you might already have lying around the house. Get a look at how via the Spark blog. We've already got pictures and instructions posted there. We'd also love it if you tell us about your own DIY hacks. Did you hack your camera? Maybe you used your sewing machine motor to power a carpet sweeper. Who knows? We want to hear about it. You can upload your photos and take a look at ours at the blog, cbc.ca/spark. Spark was made this week by Elizabeth Bowie, Dan Meisner, Tom Howell, and me, Nora Young, and by
Tom Lusher,
Terry O'Reilly,
my name's Martin Hand,
Thomas Kreese,
Barb Carey,
Ivan Bowman,
Glenn Pauly,
Yvonne McLean, and
I'm Ian McCarty.
Spark was made with Creative Commons music. You can find it listed at the blog, cbc.ca/spark.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.